Chapter 4. On April 5, 1940, a wintry day with a high of only 35 degrees, Kilgallen, then 27, married Richard Colmer, 30, a graduate of the Yale Department of Drama turned actor, singer, and Broadway producer. Variety's review of the musical Too Many Girls included calling him an exuberant comedian unspoiled by cleverness. More than 800 guests attended the lavish wedding, including actors Milton Berle and Ethel Merman, who wrote in her autobiography that she had a wonderful relationship with Kilgallen. From the political arena, the future 1944 Republican presidential candidate Thomas Dewey, who lost to Franklin D. Roosevelt, also congratulated the happy couple. Kilgallen kept her maiden name for professional purposes. Kilgallen, who scribbled notes for her column on napkins and matchbook covers, was quite honored when the owner of Reuben's, a popular delicatessen on East 58th Street, named a sandwich after her. At a festive luncheon, she washed down the ham on rye with a cold beer before autographing menus for fans that appeared out of nowhere. The cost of the Kilgallen special was $1.10. She bragged that it was 25 cents more than the Ed Sullivan sandwich. Frank Sinatra's cost $2.15. If this accolade wasn't enough, Kilgallen was later included in the lyrics for a version of The Lady is a Tramp, sung by Sammy Davis Jr. Among the lyrics describing the tramp is the line, "She reads Kilgallen, and I mean every line." Dorothy Kilgallen displayed her own brand of patriotism when she sent FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover subversive material forwarded to her from readers at the Journal American. One strong letter, forwarded at the same time Winston Churchill launched his V for Victory campaign, insinuated that she favored the Soviet Marxist Jews through her daily hate of Hitler. Once World War II ended, Kilgallen displayed quite another act of patriotism through a series of radio broadcasts designed to push the sales of war bonds, with the money designed to bring wounded GIs back from the four corners of the earth and provide treatment for them. These pre-recorded broadcasts began with an announcer who stated, "Now, Dorothy Kilgallen's Diary, the intimate behind-the-scenes stories of Broadway's greatest stars revealed by the First Lady of Broadway, the famous columnist and radio personality, Miss Dorothy Kilgallen." She then interviewed well-known entertainers of the day, such as noted singer Mary Small, who had entertained at army bases and hospitals around the world to soothe the souls of the wounded men and women. During that episode, Kilgallen told the audience, "My diary yesterday says I spent the afternoon with Mary Small, a mighty familiar name to a great many GIs. With her songs, she has brightened up many a hospital bed for the wounded at such army camps as Fort Dix. She really puts her heart into those performances." Regarding what were called victory bonds, Kilgallen reminded listeners that raising money through these bonds is where patriotism and caring about the troops come together. We need this victory drive to help bring the boys back home. When Kilgallen appeared as a guest on a WCBS New York program, the host honored her with a courtroom gavel. In part, the printing stated, "The Lady with the Brain." That she was for sure. Meanwhile, J. Edgar Hoover kept a file on Kilgallen, as revealed in FBI documents obtained by this author through the Freedom of Information Act. The file chronicled her movements and labeled her flighty and irresponsible. However, Hoover and the Bureau would learn a valuable lesson: never underestimate Kilgallen. This attitude was similar to those who tangled with Marilyn Monroe and underestimated her intelligence. Now 31 and an established reporter with few peers, male or female, Kilgallen became fascinated with the 1944 trial of Wayne Lonergan. He was charged with killing his high-society wife Patricia, heir to the Burton-Bernheimer beer fortune, at her East 51st Street triplex apartment in Manhattan after she had filed for divorce and cut him out of her will. A pair of silver candelabra was the alleged murder weapon. During the trial, set against the backdrop of the colorful fall season, Kilgallen was obsessed with Lonergan, an admitted gigolo who preyed on rich women. Several clandestine meetings in the thick of the night with reliable sources involved in the trial provided her with inside information about the defense strategies. She told one of her colleagues, "I feel like I am in a spy movie." In the end, Lonergan's confession, which he attempted to recant, resulted in a sentence of 35 years to life. Kilgallen's celebrity status at the time prompted an invitation to the White House by President Harry S. Truman. On a cold and windy day in January of 1946, she joined a star-studded cast, including actresses Angela Lansbury and Alexis Smith, actors Zachary Scott and Cesar Romero, and singer Joe Stafford. In a photo of the gathering, Kilgallen sits second from the right in the front row. The opportunity for Kilgallen to hit the radio waves with a big splash arrived on the New York City scene in early April 1945, when the daily radio program, Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick, premiered on WOR Radio. Most days it began with the hosts telling more than a million listeners, "Hi, darling. Hi, sweetie. Here we are at home in little old New York, ready to visit with our radio friends." The program tagline, "Now wake up and smell the coffee when you have breakfast with Dorothy and Dick," was employed for the popular daily show airing from 1945 through 1963. The Breakfast, broadcast live at 8:15 a.m., was one of the first of its kind, and its popularity helped spawn hundreds of similar shows around the country. Breakfast was served by their butler, and their children made regular appearances at the table while their singing canary, Robin, could be heard in the background. A Variety ad called it "homey as a front porch rocker, smart as a new spring bonnet." At one point, more than a million people listened to the broadcast each day, and mail sent to the show only had to be addressed to Dorothy and Dick with no further information. Variety called the couple the original Mr. and Mrs. Radio. Recordings of the broadcasts are available at otr.com/p/breakfast-with-dorothy-dick-dorothy-kilgallen-dick-k-o-l-l-m-a-r. Subject matter for the broadcasts varied from day to day. A reporter for the New York Post described it as "lionizing cafe society. Amid prattle, plugs, jokes, and occasional quarrels, they regaled listeners with stories of their nightclub encounters, their theater going, their latest trip to Europe, and the precocious achievements of their children." Author and artist Jojo Capace was one of those New Yorkers who recalled the program. She told this author on April 2018, "If you were a New Yorker, there were certain journalists you had to read, and Dorothy Kilgallen was one. But first thing in the morning, my parents and I listened to her radio show like everybody else. It was rather highbrow, but we enjoyed it. They sounded like the perfect American family." Despite the five decades that had passed since the show was popular, Capace easily recalled the program beginning with, "Hi, darling. Hi, sweetie." A New York Post article at the time explained a little-known fact about Kilgallen. At the beginning, Dorothy was thrown into a panic of the thought of speaking in a microphone. She used to tremble, stutter, and fracture her syntax as she tried to face the microphone. At times, she talked of giving it all up. Then she went to a speech teacher, and anyone who has listened regularly since knows how well she overcame her mic fright. She not only chatters effortlessly and endlessly, but she does it with a broad A. One story, told by Kilgallen family friend Bob Levitt, illuminates the power the radio show had in New York City and beyond. In May of 2020, this author interviewed Levitt, the son of Ethel Merman, the award-winning singer who was known primarily for her distinctive, powerful voice and various roles in musical theater, leading to her being called the undisputed first lady of the musical comedy stage. Levitt, who, along with Kilgallen's daughter Jill and son Dickie, formed what they called the Gorilla Club for fun times, remarked, "Ms. K, that's what my sister and I called her, was a veritable savior in one of my childhood's most upsetting traumatic experiences, the loss of our canary, Hansi. Thanks to her, in truth, thanks to both Dorothy and Dick, as they were known on their daily radio show, we got Hansi back within hours, unhurt, and, to judge from his home cage singing, happy to be home." How did this happen? Levitt, who remembered Kilgallen as being very formal, quite unemotional toward us as children, recalled, "It was all a small miracle, considering that he had flown out a 21st-floor window of our apartment on Central Park West. His freedom choice left my sister and I in near hysterical distress, unstoppable tears streaking our cheeks, pumped and pumped some more by the swelling hopelessness we felt, staring out the window he'd used for his escape, scanning the vast sky everywhere and anywhere that he might be." He added, "On a world scale, it was lightweight yet raw childhood trauma, and fortunately, short term. Long term, though, it became a good family story with a happy ending. And more dramatically, it was a real-life crescendo in the living truth of one of our mother's most popular songs, 'There's No Business Like Show Business.' Hansi got back home because our mom called her good friend Dorothy, Ms. K to us, and reaching her on the phone during the live broadcast of the Dorothy and Dick radio show. She told her about Hansi. Dorothy told the listening audience that Ethel Merman and her two children, Bobby and Ethel, had just lost their canary, Hansi, right around 63rd Street. And Dorothy told her audience, "If anybody sees Hansi, please call in." Apparently, Dorothy and Dick talked about Hansi for a few minutes on the air, and, lo and behold, a listener called in to report that a yellow canary had just landed on one of their apartment's exterior window sills, and, when they opened the window, the canary had hopped through it into their apartment, where it was presently sitting calmly and very still, radiating a sort of what's-next attitude. Ultimately, Hansi somehow arrived back home, presumably in a borrowed cage by taxi, making my sister and I very happy and forever indebted to Miss Kilgallen and Mr. Colmer for their professional savior services as Dorothy and Dick. Regarding her continuing career as a journalist, Paul Schoenstein, the editor at the New York Journal American who gave Kilgallen her first real shot at becoming a reporter, said boldly, "Dorothy was far and away the greatest reporter there was." The greatest reporter could also write columns having nothing to do with hard-edged journalism, demonstrating an ability to entertain devoted readers across a broad spectrum of society. On Christmas Day, 1950, she had published a poem indicating a creative talent second to none. Note the flash of headline-making names, including Irving Berlin, Mayor Robert Wagner, Andy Griffith, heavyweight champion Jack Dempsey, pianist Van Cliburn, Shirley MacLaine, Sophia Loren, Cary Grant, Dwight Eisenhower, and many more, all of whom Kilgallen knew on a friendly basis. One clever excerpt read, "Eleanor Roosevelt, Dr. Ralph Bunch, Bouncy Miss Garland, a Judy with punch, Garbo, still aloof and cool as a glacier, pert Pat Suzuko, that hip little geisha." Also included were witty John Daly, Arlene Francis, and Bennett Cerf, who would come to play a part in her gaining even greater celebrity. 2 years earlier, in 1948, Kilgallen, at age 35, had hosted the radio show People You'd Like to Know with Dorothy Kilgallen. Spotlighted were her insights into famous personalities of the day, including Broadway star Mary Martin, famous for appearing in such mega-hits as Sound of Music and South Pacific. Mary is just Mary, very friendly. Her hobby is needlework. Singer Pearl Bailey, tough but caring, adopted two children, a one-woman rescue committee. And singer Peggy Lee, electric when she sings, but picks the wrong men and is sad because of it. That's why she sings the blues. During one particular episode, Kilgallen sang the praises of actor Cary Grant, telling her audience, "If I were asked to name the most charming person I've ever met, I'd say Cary Grant. Cary is not just a movie star with looks and acting ability. In his mid-50s, he's just as handsome as he was 20 years ago, and he wears those expensive clothes of his better than any man in the world." Kilgallen added, "When I asked a young actor if he wanted to act like Cary does in his movies, he told me, 'Gee, I'd just like to put my hands in my pockets like he does on screen.'" Boasting a bit regarding her friendship with the star of such films as North by Northwest and To Catch a Thief, she said, "The last time Cary left for London, he called me 3 times before he left New York City. I wondered what he wanted, but when I reached him, he just said, 'I didn't want to go without saying goodbye.' Above all, he has gigantic charm, and it isn't anything he worked on, it just came naturally." In some ways, the famous columnist was a magnet for everything exciting in the entertainment, sports, and political worlds. All of this from a college dropout, which made her ascendancy to a position of power all the more remarkable. In late 1950, Kilgallen's success as a media icon was cemented when she was chosen to be one of the panelists on the new CBS program What's My Line? During many of the season's shows, all shown in black and white, a bevy of giant question marks appeared on the screen as the announcer said, "Time now for everybody's favorite guessing game, What's My Line?" On most live episodes, Kilgallen appeared from curtains center stage and acknowledged vigorous applause by a live audience. She then introduced the panelist to her left, usually a celebrity. She or he in turn introduced Arlene Francis, who then introduced Bennett Cerf, who then introduced John Daly. This order varied from time to time. A bit of banter followed before Daly explained the rules of the game and the first contestant entered. Daly then stated, "Would you please sign in?" whereupon the contestant wrote his or her full name on a blackboard. The lively show, which challenged the panel to guess unusual occupations, or when a celebrity guest appeared to guess their identity, aired on CBS on Sunday night for the next 17 years. At its height of popularity, the show had a weekly audience of 25 million people. Kilgallen and Francis wore fancy gowns and expensive jewelry with their hair always perfectly coiffed, Kilgallen's by her hairdresser Mark Sinclair. The men dressed in dark suits and bow ties. During its run, the program would not only garner 4 Emmy Awards, but also a Golden Globe Award for Best TV Show in 1962, the year Marilyn died. During the show, on January 14th of that year, with the panel consisting of Bennett Cerf, actor Dana Andrews, and a very young-looking Johnny Carson, host John Daly announced a special moment for the Kilgallen family. Daly said, "I've had the great joy of knowing Dorothy's mother and dad for many years, since I used to work with her dad when he was heading up the old international news service operations overseas, particularly during the war. Well, today at St. Patrick Cathedral, Dorothy's mother and father, Jim and May, were given a certificate by Cardinal Spellman because in this year, 1962, they will observe their golden wedding anniversary." Kilgallen beamed at Daly's words, a proud daughter for sure. She was also in a merry mood for having been selected again as one of America's best-dressed women. Another indication of the program's popularity happened in 1960, when the popular satirical magazine Mad included a cartoon spoofing the show. Kilgallen's cartoon name was Miss Dorothy Killbottle, with no explanation provided. In a column at this time, United Press International reporter Jack O'Brien rated the program among all those aired on the various networks. After choosing the show as the best in its category, he named John Daly, who actually played poker with Jim Kilgallen, as the best host because he holds his 4 trained egos in neat rein while keeping the show moving along at a properly brisk pace. O'Brien then turned to Kilgallen, writing, "Used to be Dorothy Kilgallen couldn't eagerly scrutinize a coat label or eye a lady's jib or analyze the richness or lack of same in fabric or jewelry without pens immediately being snapped in fists all over the country, and we could receive irate letters accusing Dolly May of snobbishness." After stating that times had changed and that Kilgallen was only learning something about the backgrounds of the show's targets, the reporter added, "Arlene Francis plays it more for laughs while Dorothy plays to win." Interestingly enough, Kilgallen herself, in another indicator of her enormous popularity, was parodied on an episode of the popular cartoon series The Flintstones. On November 10, 1961, in Season 2, Episode 9, titled The Little White Lie, Fred lies to Wilma so he can go play poker with the boys. He ends up a big winner but doesn't want Wilma to know he lied about where he went since she had other plans for him. Thinking quickly, as only Fred can do, he takes the money and sticks it in Barney's dilapidated wallet and then tells Wilma they found the wallet on the way home. Wilma, always the honest one in the family, buys Fred's story, but then telephones her friend, Daisy Kilgranite, at the Bedrock Chronicle, gives her what is the bogus story, and asks Daisy to put an ad in the newspaper to find the owner. The program cuts to Kilgranite's office, and although she is an older character than Kilgallen was at the time, she also has short white hair and wears glasses, a flowery hat, a necklace, and earrings. Her mannerisms and language are pure Dorothy. Of course, Fred's scheme is exposed in the end, but Wilma is ever the forgiving soul. Little known today is that Kilgallen and Arlene Francis appeared on the November 8, 1965 edition of the CBS daytime program To Tell the Truth. One may wonder how this could have happened, since Kilgallen had been found dead earlier in the day, as will be explained. The reason is that the show, which featured Kilgallen and Francis, as well as actress Joan Crawford, had been taped on the 2nd of November. In a new wrinkle to the popular show, each wore a black veil and had their voices distorted as the audience attempted to guess who was the real Joan Crawford. At the end of the program, newscaster Douglas Edwards announced the passing of Kilgallen, paying tribute to her many accomplishments in the field of entertainment. Unfortunately, tape of the show was wiped away a few days later, thus leaving no recording of it in existence today. In addition, Kilgallen appeared on an episode of To Tell the Truth as a panelist alongside Tom Poston, Johnny Carson, and actress Dina Merrill. The host was Bud Collier, and after Kilgallen's introduction, she said, "I'm happy to be here, but scared. You're all so good, and this isn't my line." Kilgallen's celebrity status permitted her to frequent the famous Broadway watering holes of the day, including the Copacabana and the Stork Club, where the Kennedys hung out. Phyllis Layrid recalled seeing the famous columnist late at night partying with others who were famous, including columnist Bob Considine, who called Phyllis Phil. Layrid, an impressive woman in her 90s, told this author in late 2019, "My sister Barbara Jean was close friends with Dorothy and one of the bridesmaids at her wedding at St. Patrick's Cathedral. I saw Dorothy, and since she knew my sister so well, she would wave at me at the Copa and other bars and restaurants. She always looked stunning, laughed a lot, looked great on What's My Line?" Layrid added, "Barbara talked about the wedding, exciting. She was very intimidated about St. P's Cathedral. I saw Dorothy with her husband Richard, but he seemed kind of sappy. Nice looking, looked weak to me. That was the way I felt about him. Couldn't figure out what she saw in Richard. So many attractive men. Such an exciting time." During this time, singer Johnny Ray burst onto the national scene with the best-selling songs Cry and The Little White Cloud That Cried. His album featuring Please Mr. Sun became another of his hit records. A top music publication lauded his lachrymose, ranting style. This inspired several nicknames, among them Prince of Wales, Nabob of Sob, and the Atomic Ray. Kilgallen mentioned the crooner in her Voice of Broadway column, writing, "A simply awful thing has happened to me. How am I going to say it? Goodness, it's too frightful, really. Steel yourself, girl. Get it off your bodice once and for all. All right, here it is. I've come to just love Johnny Ray's record of Please, Mr. Sun. Now will anybody ever speak to me again?" Kilgallen decided to check out Ray's performance herself. In April 1952, Ray appeared at the high society Copacabana, along with the famous Copa Girls. The billing also featured ventriloquist Jimmy Nelson, famous for his Nestle chocolate commercials featuring Farfel the dog. On the 10th of that month, a quarrel between Kilgallen and husband Richard broke out when he made a disparaging remark about Johnny Ray's singing prowess on the couple's WOR radio show. Always keen to report Kilgallen's news and views, the Saturday Evening Post noted that the couple almost came to crockery throwing over the episode. Along with Kilgallen, celebrities who flocked to the popular Broadway nightclubs, including the Copa, to see their favorite stars included mobster Frank Costello, allegedly the Copa's true owner through a front man, Frank Sinatra, who appeared there, and J. Edgar Hoover, the pug-faced, power-hungry FBI director who enjoyed being treated as a celebrity despite having nothing to do with the entertainment arena. Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis first launched their act at the Copa, and the Barry Manilow song Copacabana was named after the trendy nightclub. When Ray performed his hit Walkin' My Baby Back Home at the Copa, Kilgallen joined the SRO crowd with a standing ovation. In her Voice of Broadway column the next day, she wrote of Ray, "Endsville, he held the town's toughest audience spellbound. Or maybe it was paralyzed with astonishment." On June 12, 1953, Kilgallen attended Queen Elizabeth II's coronation. Wearing a tiara, Kilgallen looked stunning in a silver gown with 10,000 embroidered jewels and pearls encrusted at the scalloped neckline. A white mink cape lined with silver lamé completed an outfit truly fit for a media queen. Kilgallen's coverage of the coronation earned her a Pulitzer Prize nomination, surprisingly the only one she received during her long and illustrious journalistic career. When the Queen visited Williamsburg, Virginia in 1957, a press plane carrying reporters that had been following her Canadian tour taxied up to the airport terminal, according to a New York Post account. As the door of the plane opened, the reporters stated, "Some of the most bedraggled, ill-use, sagging newspaper women in America hustled down the ramp, loaded down under typewriters, portfolios, attaché cases, etc. Last of all came Dorothy Kilgallen, slim, poster-perfect, smiling, daintily towing her way downward, unwrinkled, unruffled, fresh-faced, in a brown suit with a chinchilla beret, carrying a makeup case and little else." Whether the Queen noticed Kilgallen upon arrival is unknown, but while many of the Voice of Broadway column readers were most interested in her top-notch expertise as a gossip columnist, Kilgallen continued to write front-page stories featuring her favorite subjects, crime and criminal trials. To that end, the headline-making case Kilgallen tackled involved the Cleveland murder trial of Dr. Sam Shepard, on trial for killing his wife. He swore he was innocent and that a bushy-haired, one-armed man, whom he had confronted in their home, struck Mrs. Shepard with a sharp metal object 27 times. Prior to jury instructions, Judge Edward Blythin asked to meet Kilgallen privately. The two posed for photos while chatting. Later, Bob Considine, writing for the Hearst Syndicate, described Kilgallen's star power. Dorothy's daily arrivals at the little courtroom in Cleveland, where Sam Shepard was on trial, were not unlike the arrival at home plate of Mickey Mantle with the bases filled. All the girl wanted was to get on with the story, do her job, but the jury, judge, defense attorney, prosecution, and warring families of the accused murderer and the deceased all seemed straining to get her autograph. Reporting such hard-edge news caused the elite of the New York City reporting world to take special notice of Kilgallen. The legendary Damon Runyon, impressed with Kilgallen's exploits, wrote of her, "She has soft, dark hair and huge, appealing eyes that gaze at you with an expression of infinite innocence buried in their azure depths. She looks so young and helpless that you say to yourself, 'My goodness, I must assist this poor child in her work. I must have shied her from the rough edges of life.' Then you turn your watchfulness to the hard-eyed members of the sterner sex, and you are positively shocked when you pick up the journal the next day and discover that the little girl with the eyes of a gazelle has scooped your eyes off. Ah, yes, that Kilgallen girl." Asked at the time why Kilgallen had become so successful as a reporter, her father Jim told the New York Post, "This is the greatest working newspaper woman alive. She's friendly with everyone she works with, but first of all, she is a newspaper woman. She'll be sitting in court and suddenly have an angle in the testimony, and bang, she is out like a dart dictating to her office." This skill would come in handy later when Kilgallen covered the Jack Ruby trial. Jim added, "Some people have criticized her for this, but hell, she's a newspaper woman first. Hell, she's even done that to me. First you think, 'That little brat, my own daughter.' Then you start to think, 'Why didn't I think of that?' And you realize and respect her for what she is, one hell of a newspaper gal." Meanwhile, that Kilgallen girl continued to be enamored with singer Johnny Ray, as was, apparently, Marilyn Monroe, who appeared with him in Irving Berlin's 1954 20th Century Fox musical comedy drama There's No Business Like Show Business. More about the Dorothy, Marilyn, Johnny triad to come. In fact, the singer and the famous actress appeared at all of New York City's watering holes while promoting the film. Photos of the two and ones of Kilgallen with the crooner were commonplace during this time. More fully documenting Kilgallen's appearance at the Sam Shepard trial was a November 13, 1954 TV Guide article entitled "Dorothy Kilgallen, Girl Reporter." Confirming Kilgallen as the most famous reporter of her time, the article, written under the byline, "A Television Star Covers Cleveland's Shepard Trial," began, "Television's Dorothy Kilgallen found herself, as the drama of the state of Ohio versus Dr. Samuel Shepard rocketed along, laying the feminine lead in the case which surrounded the famous Cleveland trial. In her role of nationally syndicated newspaper columnist and girl reporter, the sharp-witted What's My Line panelist received almost as much prominence as the handsome society osteopath accused of killing his wife. Her fame enabled her to get closer to the principals in the case than other members of the television, radio, or press crews. She also was besieged by autograph collectors and photographers, and, believe it or not, was dragged into the long, drawn-out wrangle over the selection of the jury." Kilgallen was quoted in the article as saying, "I've been working hard since I was 17 years old to get where I am now, and although the attention slows me down, I am grateful to give autographs." Regarding her working hard, the TV Guide journalist wrote, "She arrived by plane at 4 a.m. Monday, after appearing on What's My Line Sunday night. She was in bed at her hotel by 5, up again at 8, and at the courthouse by 9:45. At 4:30 p.m., she caught a plane back to New York for an evening with her three children and her husband, Broadway producer Richard Colmer. Up Tuesday at 5:30 a.m., she and her husband recorded two sessions of their daily 15-minute radio program. And before noon, Dottie was back in Cleveland. In addition to all of this, she found time to do her daily column, Voice of Broadway, which runs in approximately 100 newspapers, and, oh yes, to write those colorful, day-to-day stories of the trial which brought her to Cleveland in the first place." Listening to the evidence during the 9-week trial, Kilgallen had doubts about Shepard's guilt, telling readers, "He is either a brutal killer or a man in a nightmare." When the jury voted for conviction, the newspaper headline read, "Dorothy Kilgallen on Shepard Trial. Astounded by verdict, sees reversal possible." The accompanying story stated, The prosecutors for the state of Ohio did not prove Shepard was guilty any more than they proved there were pinheaded men on Mars. I have covered a score and more of murder trials. This was the first time I have ever seen what I believed to be miscarriage of justice in a murder case. It is the first time I have ever been scared by the jury system, and I mean scared.